Good evening, this is Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida. Welcome to Tuesday Topics. I'd like to thank Marlena for recording tonight, and probably Steve Bowers, if not others in the huge metropolis of ACB Radio, for their editing of this program to turn it into a listenable program on ACB Radio. And of course, we'd like to thank George Byes and Talking Communities for making his software available to us so that Tuesday Topics can happen at all. It was our intention tonight to do a program on National Industries for the Blind, but contact was not made with the guest we had planned to have tonight. And so the group of us who are here tonight have decided that we're going to talk a little about the democratic process in ACB, how it works, how good is it, what are some of the alternatives to the current approaches that are being taken that have been discussed, and what is the process. So I suppose that one of the ways that we can begin, and by the way, we are aware that this will air after the convention, so you can sort of measure the practical outcomes that occur during the convention against some of our theoretical insights as expressed in this program. So let me start by describing the governance of ACB a little bit so that people will have an idea of exactly how things work. ACB is governed by officers and directors. The officers are elected in odd-numbered years, and the directors are elected in even-numbered years. Directors serve for 4-year terms. Officers serve for 2-year terms. There are term limits, 2 terms per director and 3 terms per officer. We have, according to our Constitution, a strong executive director. That is an executive director who is expected to be the spokesperson for ACB a good deal of the time constitutionally, and who is empowered to run the operation of ACB, at least to a degree, as the leader of our staff. This is a big change, by the way, and was part of our 5-year plan that was passed a few years ago. The situation with ACB before, perhaps because of where it began, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about that, was that we essentially were very leery of giving very much power to staff, and most of the power resided with the board. We didn't even call the person who was the lead official in ACB, the executive director. We called him the national representative, and actually gave him very little power. There was the expectation that the board would make virtually all of the decisions until this most recent 5-year plan, which supposedly changed things. So that's an idea of the governance of ACB. In the NFB, there are no term limits, and it is expected that a really good leader, a president, will in fact stay in office for life. And there are those in ACB who believe that that's okay. A lot of us, however, think that term limits are actually a good idea. And speaking as a former officer, I wouldn't fight anybody who said that there should only be 2 2-year terms. I would actually find that pretty appropriate. So that's essentially the governance. So this year we're electing members to the board of directors. Oh, actually there is a component of the government that I haven't described, and that is the board of publications. The board of publications consists of 5 members, the chair, who is appointed by the president, 2 other members who are appointed by the president, and 2 members who are elected by the membership. The board of publications is intended to assure that there is a free press in ACB. And that is, it is the responsibility of the Board of Publications constitutionally to be a wedge between the leadership of ACB and the membership of ACB. When ACB started, the Braille Free Press was an important element of expressing the disaffection of people with the National Federation of the Blind. And so the Board of Publications was essentially set up so that it would be sure that if there were things that needed to be said about what leaders were doing, the ACB would in fact have the ability through its publications to publish that sort of thing. One of the questions that we might ask is whether the Board of Publications is currently fulfilling that role, whether it has over the past few years. That's a very moot point. But that, in my view, is what it is constitutionally supposed to do. So perhaps the next thing we ought to talk about is the way elections work, because that's also an interesting process. Just for reference, we will compare ACB's approach to electing people with NFB's. When the NFB is electing a member to their board of director, each of their affiliates has one vote. None of the people in the audience have votes at all. The individual representing that affiliate has the opportunity to vote, and each affiliate casts its vote for nominees to the board of directors. I'm not sure that it's always the case, but it's very often the case that members of the NFB board run unopposed. And that is not inconsistent with NFB's notion of democracy, because they say that good leadership will come to the fore and that it isn't necessary to have contested elections to have democracy. ACB's process is a little different and still perhaps not perfect. In ACB's system, elections are conducted with two distinct segments. One segment is called the standing vote, and the other segment is called the affiliate vote. The standing vote means that everyone present in the room who has the appropriate badge with a dot on it has the capacity to stand and vote in a contested election. If there is a contested election, usually the standing vote is taken first. Then an affiliate vote is taken. The affiliate vote is a little complicated and very much different from the way that the National Federation of the Blind operates. The maximum number of votes that any state can have is 25. Those 25 votes account for 625 members of an affiliate, and there are a number of affiliates within the ACB. There are a number of affiliates within the ACB who in fact exceed or would exceed 25 votes if we counted them all. This is another of the questions about democracy. Should in fact our larger affiliates have the votes to which they're entitled, or is it appropriate to do what we do in ACB, which is to say that no state ought to have so many votes that they can categorically dominate an election. For example, California, I think, has well over 2,000 members. They only pay for 625 members, and they only have 25 votes because, as you can easily tell, there are one vote for every 25 members. When an affiliate on the floor at ACB says so-and-so casts its five votes, they're actually casting votes for 125 ACB members. Up until 3 years ago, there had never been a time when the affiliate vote actually differed from the outcome of the standing vote. I don't know whether that remains true. I'm actually inclined to think it may not, but it's an interesting statistic, because one would have thought that there would have been occasions when the affiliate vote and the standing vote would not have come out the same way. But that has never happened. At least that is the received knowledge of Jim Olson, who has counted votes in ACB for an awfully long time. So the standing vote and the affiliate vote are added together, and the winner is determined by having a majority of those two in a two-person election. If there are more than two people involved in an election, the bottom person is dropped off the list as a matter of course, and then the remaining number of participants remain in the race until either someone gets a majority of the votes cast or until we're down to two when somebody must. That's a quick description of the electoral process. Is there a component? Well, yeah, there is. There's a lot of stuff that I've left out. That's the process of conducting the elections themselves. But the electoral process is actually a good deal more interesting. I've been talking an awfully long time. Brian, are you back? Would you like to talk a little bit about the run-up to the actual vote? Maybe talk about statements on web pages and campaigning and that kind of thing?
I'd be happy to. Really, the process of electioneering begins quite a bit of time prior to the convention. Specifically, it happens when an individual decides that they're going to run for election, and they begin talking about that, typically the year before at the prior convention, talking to friends and supporters and the like to see whether or not their candidacy might be met positively. Then there's an announcement that comes out of the Board of Publications indicating that any individual who wishes to can answer a set number of questions proposed by the Board of Publications. And if you fill out that form, appropriate number of words per question, typically it's about 5 questions, and it gets into the editor of the Braille Forum by the deadline, then the webmaster cleans it up in terms of making it postable without altering it in any significant fashion. And that's one way that individuals can hear about the ideas and views of potential candidates. During that time also, those candidates are out talking to friends who they know will be attending the upcoming convention and who are likely to be delegates from their respective affiliates serving on the ACB nominating committee. The nominating committee is unique in ACB in that it's the only one that holds closed meetings. Each affiliate is granted a single individual in the nominating committee. They meet early in the week. I think this year it's Monday or Tuesday. I don't remember which of the 2 days. And after every affiliate has signed in, the doors are closed. Nobody's allowed in or out. I shouldn't say that because you can get out. You just can't get back in again. And the chair of the committee then calls the roll. And then we go through an electoral process. The chair of this year's committee happens to be from my home state here of Massachusetts, Judy Cannon. And she has posted the rules by which the committee will operate this year. There will be a number of positions where the incumbents are eligible for re-election. She is going to take those first board members in alphabetical order, and then any open seats, and then proceed on to the Board of Publications positions in the same fashion. Individuals stand up and nominate individuals to those offices, and then after all the nominations for a specific office are completed, each candidate is then asked to indicate who's going to give their firsting and seconding speeches. Typically, we limit those to a combined length of about 5 minutes. Then an election is held, again, each affiliate with a single vote, each affiliate at least present in the committee, and following the same process you described a moment ago, Paul, for when the election hits the floor, they elect nominees for each of the positions. This is supposed to be closed, so you're really not supposed to discuss it, though frequently people do. And the nominating committee chairperson announces the next day on the floor the nominating committee's recommendations for the different positions. They not only announce the individual, but they're also required to announce the home state of that individual and the occupation of that individual. No, and there are limits on in terms of who can run from which states. You cannot have 2 members who are holding director positions from the same state, but all officers can be from the same state, and an officer certainly can be from a state that has a board member or a director as well. There are no such limitations, as I understand it, for the Board of Publication elected positions. So now I guess I've spoken long enough, and we'll pass the microphone on to somebody else to describe the next part of the process.
Well, actually, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. What's the rationale, do you think, for limiting the members of the directors to one state and not limiting officers in the first place? And then, perhaps as a follow-up question, what do you see as the purpose of developing a slate of officers?
I guess the first question I would say, the issue really is a matter of trying to keep a single state from controlling everything. While the Constitution says that all officers could be from the same state, it rarely has happened that it's been even close to that. Currently, the president, the second vice president are both from the same state. I don't think any of the other officers overlap states where there's representatives. I could be wrong there, but I don't think so. In terms of this, I guess if I were to write the Constitution, I would have prohibited that. But in the early days of ACB, we didn't have that many states to draw from. And as a result, they probably felt at that time that it was doable for the directorships, but not doable for the officer cadre. To limit it to a single state. Now we have many, many more affiliates, and I would think that it wouldn't be difficult at all to determine that you couldn't have more than one officer from a state, neither could you have more than one director from the same state to assure that kind of diversity.
There was a resolution, in fact, put forward in Florida to do precisely that, to send it forward to ACB. And interestingly enough, the resolution was defeated. And it was defeated on the grounds that at least Florida perceived that there was a fundamental difference between officers and board members, and that officers might have some leadership qualities that would be important to be sure we could tap into. Last year, by the way, we had as many as 3 people from California because Artis Basin was also there. It's also probably worth saying that California is our largest affiliate as well. And so even though you do have 3 people from the same state, you also have 3 people from our largest affiliate in terms of numbers, and a group that probably constitutes 20% of ACB's total membership. So in a sense, viewed in that context, it's not quite so bad. Okay, how about a slate of officers?
I want to go back to your previous question. Why would we use the nominating committee approach? And to me, the reason for that is to give the opportunity for each affiliate to have equal standing at some point in the process. Since clearly when we get down to the floor, the bigger affiliates have the greater influence than the smaller affiliates. So it's somewhat like trying to deal with the issue of a bicameral legislature where the Senate, all states, no matter what their size, have the same number of representatives, while the lower house has representative proportionate to the total population of a given state. So I think it's an attempt to balance in that regard.
Gosh, that's interesting. I would never have picked that as the primary value of the nominating committee. I would have said, and I'll give you an opportunity to respond to this as well, I would have said that the process that the nominating committee fulfills are 3. First, to give folks an opportunity to float candidacies in a nice, quiet, closed environment where if they fall flat on their duffs, it won't be a big deal. Second, to get a barometric reading on where ACB as a whole might appear to be coming from for people who are obviously viable in terms of candidacy. And third, perhaps to let people who are allegedly experienced and have some previous involvement with ACB come up with a recommended slate of officers, which will by default perhaps be the folks who many people in ACB will choose to vote for because they've already essentially been given the imprimatur of one of the major committees of ACB. But I'll let you respond to that, Brian. Would you buy into those values of the nominating committee as well?
The first one, yes. It is a place where one can float a candidacy, see whether or not it has the legs necessary to even have a prayer when it reaches the full floor. Clearly, that does happen there. Rarely is somebody elected from the floor who had a very poor showing in committee, though people who lose narrowly in committee frequently have been elected from the floor. The second one, which is where the committee is filled with quasi-leaders within the organization, have an opportunity to let the rest of the membership know kind of what the collective wisdom might suggest. That might be a good idea in theory, but it hasn't proven to be at all true, I think, in practice over the past 20-some-odd years that I've been watching that process. I would say that overall is probably a combination of all of these things and imperfect in each of its aspects, but perhaps collectively still performing a valuable service to the membership.
Well, Brian, you've laid yourself open for this question. If it hasn't been doing what it is supposed to have been doing for the last 20 years, what has the nominating committee been doing?
Now, I didn't say that. I said the idea that somehow or other it comes out with a collective wisdom based on leaders being the individual selected to serve on the committee. On those times when it's been my role to serve as a representative of one of the affiliates in the committee, at least 50% of the others in the room I wouldn't have perceived as being the leaders of their respective affiliates. But I do think that collectively, between the idea of floating candidacies in a collective wisdom, in providing some kind of balance between one affiliate, one vote, and the majority rule kind of process, that the end result typically is a service to the membership in both weeding out candidates qualifying candidates and giving us an opportunity to hear what kinds of issues some of the leaders of ACB believe are important.
I was hoping to get you to explore some of the dynamics of the nominating committee, and you did explore some of them. I think the point you make is interesting. One of the questions that I would really have is whether anyone has really spent some time explaining to the membership of ACB what the nominating committee is about and what it's for. I think there are a lot of people who simply select somebody to go to the nominating committee because they, as a leader, don't want to go, and not because they believe it's a very important process. It's an obligation that an affiliate has, but it's not something that so many people take very seriously. And I think others go not because of the constitutional components, but as a political gesture. There certainly is a good deal of work that is done behind the scenes by potential candidates to try to stack the nominating committee with people who are likely to vote for him or her. And I think increasingly over the past few years, though I haven't been in the nominating committee much, so this is secondhand, inappropriate hearsay that I'm providing. But I think in the last few years, there's also been the emergence of what amounts to a new component, and that is the existence of an amalgam of a range of affiliates who tend, as a result of prior agreement, to vote in the same way throughout the electoral process, whether during the nominating committee or in elections on the floor. So to me, that makes the process a good deal less perfect for all of those reasons, because I think the nominating committee is a place where people ought to really be looking at the degree to which each of the candidates who make presentations there are well represented and make decisions based on what they hear and also what they know about candidates without reference to a clique or a block of votes. Okay, so the nominating committee process happens on Monday evening, and on Tuesday morning, the chair of the nominating committee provides a listing of the slate of officers or the slate of board members. So is that the end of it? Are these the folks who we have to elect, or is there another process that goes on after that?
Certainly. The full process of campaigning begins Tuesday morning, though there's certainly some opportunities earlier in the week to start talking to affiliate presidents and what I guess the world of politics in general calls opinion leaders. Affiliates announce from the floor and or in our daily newspaper that they're going to hold caucuses where they are going to either invite candidates to come speak or disinvite candidates as a whole from coming to speak to them. Typically, though, it's to invite candidates to come to speak, and it's associated with either a at breakfast or before breakfast, at lunch or before lunch, at dinner or before dinner, and sometimes during the special interest affiliate meetings that happen throughout the afternoon between Monday and Election Day Friday. So candidates find their way to these different meetings. We tend to line up in the hallway. We're not usually invited to come into the room and hear what the other candidates have to say. We're usually ushered in one at a time. That seems to be a growing tendency. It wasn't always that way, but it seems to be a growing tendency in ACB right now. They come up one at a time before the members have given an affiliate meeting together and simply pontificate on subjects that matter to them. This goes on throughout the days leading up to the election. And there's a second opportunity or forum for them to speak, and that's during what's called the Candidates Forum, hosted by the Board of Publications with some preset questions written up by members of the Board of Publication and questions turned in by people in a suggestion box at the registration desk. A moderator picks from those questions and alternates between candidates, giving them an opportunity to speak before an audience of those who are interested enough to sacrifice one of their evenings during the convention to hear what the candidates have to say. Then we hit the floor and we go through a similar process to that as nominating committee. The nominee from the committee is placed into nomination. Other nominations are called for from the floor. Those individuals eventually have speakers speak on their behalf, dividing about 5 minutes of time. And then we hold the election as you've described earlier in the broadcast. Generally speaking, that's the way candidacies are done. There have been times when candidates have put together campaign committees and they have a dozen or more people
people going out talking about how great that would be if we could only elect this person to office. For the most part, campaigning has been a positive experience. That is, you campaign on what you or your candidate can bring to the ACB board or board of publications rather than campaigning on what the other guy, what the problem with electing the other guy who's running for that same position. It very much gets caught up in the issues of the day, whether it be issues of how to balance the budget of ACB or raise more money or raise more members or be more consistent with regards to our legislative process or rather how we determine priorities in doing legislative work in Washington, D.C. All of those kinds of things play a part in the campaign trail.
I think that's an interesting analysis. I'd add two or three things to it. Very often, based on their performance in the nominating committee, people who come second, particularly in board elections, make a decision that they're going to run, and as a result will actually get involved in the caucus process, even though they have not yet been nominated, and will not, in fact, be nominated until they are nominated from the floor. This affords caucuses an opportunity to actually not only hear what candidates have to say, but more importantly, to ask some very specific questions in a relatively private or supposedly relatively private environment. Typically, a lot of the really difficult questions, as well as a lot of the politically captious questions, get asked of candidates in caucuses, I think. How much value do you think there is in caucuses and or the candidates forum?
I think there's a lot of value in caucuses before affiliates. That's where a candidate gets an opportunity to see what really matters to affiliates. It's also an opportunity for them to be forced to think on their feet in front of people. You might be in a large affiliate and have an opportunity to speak pro or con about changing the one vote for 25 members back home scenario. Or you may be asked, how are you going to deal with dividing vehicle donation monies when a vehicle is donated within a state that has a program, but the money is being donated to the national organization? And some of those times you can walk yourself straight into a pretty tight corner by answering those questions. I've always seen the best answers or the most straightforward answers without apologizing for opinion, but describing the opinion.
And the candidates forum, does that have a valid role to play?
I think it very much did at the beginning. But the candidates forum, really its value is highly dependent on the number of people who show up at it. We've been at candidates forums before where the turnout of people to watch the candidates and listen to the candidates answer questions was only barely larger than the number of candidates up on the podium. And yet we've seen others where it was standing room only. So it's really a hit and miss situation in terms of you being able to reach out to people and answer their questions and people having an opportunity to see the candidates in action up in front of an audience and having to brave some pretty impressive questions both from the BOP and from those in the audience. There have been talk about discontinuing the candidates forum, but I think that it needs to kind of be there for those times when there is a hard-fought race to give one more opportunity when it's going to be a close race for the presidency or a big enough race that it might turn the nature of the Board of Publications or Board of Directors. So I for one, would vote in favor of its continuance, but realize there's going to be hot years and cold years.
I guess the other comment that I would make about the candidates forum is that it's typically broadcast on ACB radio, which means people who aren't at the convention actually have an opportunity to tune in if they choose to. I'm not sure that we have any really accurate statistics to know how many people actually are politically responsible enough to tune in, and I think the number would be divided by about 100 in terms of those people who would feel compelled after hearing something to call their affiliate president, which they certainly have the right to do, at the convention and say, I really want you to take this candidacy seriously and I want part of our affiliate vote cast in his or her favor. So it at least potentially allows individuals who aren't at the convention to become involved a little bit in the electoral process, and that probably has some value. I will make this comment rather than asking Brian to make it. I think it's interesting, and I don't know the degree to which it has an effect, but there certainly have been occasions in the last few years where candidates have not chosen to post to the Board of Publications page on our website, where candidates have not chosen to go to caucuses, where I don't think there have been many instances where candidates have not chosen to go to the candidates forum, but those individuals have gotten elected anyway. So one of the questions that you have to ask is, do these processes like caucuses and like the information on the webpage actually have much of an impact on the final result? And I don't know the answer, but it certainly is a question worth pondering. So we're now to nominations from the floor, which happen, and speeches which happen. In general, though it's not by any means a rule, most candidates like to have a speaker from the affiliate of which they are a member, and then someone who is a strong speaker who can talk more about their qualities. So while it's not a rule, I think most people would agree that if you can do it, people kind of expect it. And if a candidate doesn't have someone speaking for him from his own affiliate, there are often folks in the audience who will be saying, I wonder why his own affiliate wouldn't speak for him. Gosh, if that's the case, I don't know if I want to elect that person. So that about takes us to the end of the electoral process. Let me just throw a question out at the group. We've now described the ACB electoral process. Is this a good process? Is it fair? What about our process would we like to change?
Well, I think it's a pretty good process. From what I hear, it's more democratic than NFBs. But I think what might make it better is if those who, like people who attend the conventions, usually can vote on the nominees and things like that. But it's too bad that in some way that people who aren't at the convention can vote, some by way of the ACB radio or somewhere by way they can do it on the internet.
I think another thing that I have heard from folks in my years of being in ACB, actually I guess two things. One is that there's a perception that I have heard that it's very hard to run for the board. Not that the service is necessarily difficult or not, but the process, that it used to be a more quote-unquote user-friendly process. And I guess a comment I want to just throw in while I have the talking stick is that I think the web page is great, the Board of Publications web page where the candidates answer the questions. But it always strikes me as interesting that one of the arguments folks make over and over and over is that a small percentage of ACB members are computer users, and so I'm not completely sure how that all fits together. The other thing that I have heard from new people in ACB is the voting process, that there is a feeling that you really have more than one vote. You've got your personal standing vote. You've got how you can try to influence your affiliate. And then, oh, by the way, however darn many special affiliates you belong to. And I'd be curious to hear either of you comment on any of that.
I would say that it is certainly harder to run today than it was, say, 20 years ago. The caucuses took off, and they create almost an impossible schedule. You might find that you're supposed to be speaking in a suite on the 15th floor of the hotel. At the same time, you're supposed to be speaking at a breakfast down in the convention center. And there's little or no consideration given to candidates when affiliates establish the time or location of their caucuses. With respect to the kind of one-person, one-vote scenario, and I'm going to drop Gary's question in here as well. One-person, one-vote, I think, is a very good thing. But when you take a look at the percentage of individuals who come to our conventions versus those who are not in a financial position to do so, I think one person, one vote would result in disenfranchising an awful lot of people. There is this issue of having perhaps to determine which affiliate is going to carry your collective vote, which affiliate is going to be allowed to count you as one of 25 for each one of their votes. When I talk to people who are strong leaders in some of our special interest affiliates, they're convinced that that would end up resulting in special interest affiliates having little or no say in election processes and voting on issues related processes as well.
I guess the special interest affiliate question is one of the more vexing ones in the whole voting process. One of the contentions about the special interest affiliates is that if you're a member, people are going to actually vote for you from that affiliate. And that doesn't always happen. I think that in terms of dealing with the special interest affiliate issue, one of the things that I have proposed anyway is giving special interest affiliates half a vote and not one. That is giving them the same importance, allowing the same kind of manipulation that happens with special interest affiliates, but only making it half as important as a state affiliate vote. I think the idea of trying to choose which area you want your vote to be counted in is not one. Often, special interest affiliates and state affiliates will indicate that if they hear from members how they want them to vote, they'll take that into consideration. But very often, when the votes are actually counted, it doesn't appear that they're doing it.
I think there's also some truth in the idea that, let's say that there are three candidates for a position. Your affiliate may have in caucus indicated which one they want to vote for, but then your delegate out on the floor may be the only one sitting in your delegation because everybody else is sitting there with their states. So there might be and I'm not picking on any particular affiliates because they're guilty of it more than anybody else, because they certainly aren't. But let's say Lua has one chair, BRL, one chair, GDUI, one chair, FIA, one chair. The list goes on and on. And if there's a big important issue and you want to get your word or your idea under consideration by your delegate, then you're racing all over the hall trying to pull that off.
So one of the suggestions that Gary raised is the idea of people who aren't at convention being able to vote. If we wanted to do that, we'd have to have some sort of internet voting or a mail ballot. Are there any thoughts as to whether this would be a good thing?
Well, I think it would be a great thing. I know Guide Dog users looked at it, maybe 5 years ago, and couldn't really come up with a system. The technology just was not there. But I think that it may be there now through telephone voting, that kind of a scenario. But, you know, once again, there would have to be, I think, a structure in place so that if Marlena isn't at convention, Marlena can vote, but she can only vote once, and only she can vote. So I certainly think that it would be very well worth investigating. I think that as technology evolves, it will be even more possible. But I think that it would be a wonderful way to perhaps attract additional members, that we do not want to see any of our members disenfranchised, and so we're offering this as a way in which to vote. On the other side of the coin, I suppose people could say, well, this could conceivably, between having sort of a telephone/internet voting and ACB radio broadcasting, why should anybody go?
I think the telephone voting could be good, but I think probably internet voting, if the technology allows it, would be the best way, in my opinion, to do it.
So let me throw out a couple of what-ifs, then. Let's assume that what you're saying is you want an individual to be able to vote on candidates. All candidates would have to declare, and I mean all candidates would have to declare in advance of the convention. All candidates would have to have an opportunity, some way of getting the information out to members about what they would bring to such an office. We were talking earlier about the difficulties of campaigning in the current method. Well, imagine the financial ramifications of having to campaign to all 20-some-odd thousand, or whatever the number currently is, members of ACB remotely. Very, very difficult thing to pull off, I would imagine. Also, you don't have the opportunity to necessarily meet the candidate, which all those who go to convention do have that opportunity to meet all the candidates. If they're interested in doing so, there's opportunity there. That would not be the case for anybody who votes without going to convention. I think the end result could very easily be that the leadership would control the vote much more grandly than they currently do, and there'd be a big split between those who can financially handle running for election and those who cannot, even greater than currently, which is only those who go to convention have ever won election to convention. I don't know of a single person who's had their name put in absentia been able to successfully run for office. That's one of the issues. And if it's not a candidacy, it's a subject issue, like for resolutions or constitutional amendments. I think, quite honestly, the constitutional amendment ones very easily could be done by a mail ballot kind of an approach, because you're not really, by the way that the constitutional amendments work, you either pass them or you defeat them. You do not amend them from the floor. That is not the case with resolutions. Resolutions are frequently and consistently amended from the floor. So how would you know how to cast a vote on a resolution? I guess all this comes down to the idea that probably some of what we do people could vote on from home, but the vast majority of what we do, it would cause more problems than it would solve, I think.
Well, I think clearly, first of all, I think those are excellent points, and I don't necessarily disagree with you on any of them, but I think clearly people who voted from a distance would have to be tuned in some way, shape, or form, whether it's through ACB radio or, you know, through who knows what, whatever ACB radio may evolve into. I don't think they could do it without having some kind of connection, and I guess that's along the lines of where my mind was going.
Now, I've been thinking about this whole idea of dividing the issue. So maybe we can't allow members across the country to vote from home on all subjects and all candidacies, but maybe we can divide the question. Like I said, the Constitution and bylaws would be a good example of an issue that's either thumbs up or thumbs down, and that could be developed in advance of the convention, and the results announced at the convention, as opposed to the actual election taking place there. That's one possibility in terms of issue-oriented voting. In terms of candidate-oriented voting, we might consider taking the board of directors positions and designating two of those positions as positions at large and allowing a national, if you will, paper ballot for those two positions. That would mean that whatever decision was made, those individuals would have a voice, but they wouldn't have a controlling voice, because there'd still be the issue of how truly knowledgeable a person could be out in the hinterlands, never having attended a convention, never having met the individuals, never having an opportunity to discuss things in as much depth as takes place at a convention. What do you think of that as an idea?
I think I'd have a problem with it, because even though Constitution and bylaw amendments can't formally be amended from the floor, they are debated on the floor, and they are defeated or passed on the floor. And very often a constitutional amendment, when it's sent out, looks pretty logical until someone who's had experience actually talks about that amendment from the floor. Again, I would hate to have people voting on constitutional amendments who, for the most part, hadn't even come close to having read the ACB Constitution and who weren't exposed to an opportunity to explore exactly what the ramifications of that particular change is likely to be. I want to raise another issue. We have campaigned nationally all over the country for the idea of a secret ballot. We say that blind people have the right to vote privately and independently. Can blind people vote privately and independently at ACB now? And if they can't, should they be able to?
Oh boy, what a question, Paul. I don't think there's a thing secret about the way we vote in ACB, and I'm extremely uncomfortable with it. I have voted recently and in my past years in ACB in very unpopular ways, according to whatever affiliate I happened to belong to in whatever state I was living. And it made me feel really uncomfortable. And, you know when you're the only one standing, and it's just, it's extremely uncomfortable. And I think that before we look at having people voting from a distance, I'd like to see ACB look at how can the people who are there vote with dignity and privacy, because we ain't doing it now, in my opinion.
Paul and I got an opportunity to see the World Blind Union cast ballots, and there the candidates had to declare in advance. Ballots were created. There was a, if you will, a polling place where you would take and collect your ballot. You'd be validated off the membership list. You'd pass into a voting booth, and in that voting booth you could mark your ballot. These ballots were in Braille and raised large print with circles next to each candidate. You'd color in the circle, so to speak, a raised circle, and then tuck that ballot into a box, and somebody, a committee, was responsible for counting it. It meant that you would elect first thing in the morning and then find out what the results were at break, and if there had to be a tie, new ballots had to be created, and another election happened. So you were pretty much voting throughout the entire length of the process to achieve full voting on all candidates and all issues. But clearly, they were private ballots.
There have been incidents in stand-up where a vote has been called, and when people aren't voting a way that is favorable, they are spoken to later by others who are involved. The pressure was put on by that person or those helping that to vote for the sighted member that are standing around count. I stood by people doing that counting, telling, oh, so-and-so was not. There is just a lot of this going on. The flip side to it, I suppose, that someone say would be, well, you know, if you really believe in what you are standing for, then what does it matter if seen? So there is that side of it, but it certainly is not a private.
I think that privacy is more important when voting for officers or directors in general than it is on constitution, bylaws, resolutions, etc. Not always, but in general. And I think one has to start to take a look at this somewhere. And so I would love to see the ACB board look at ways in which more privacy and dignity could be afforded to voting members in the election of officers and directors, and then maybe go from there.
I don't think that the ballot is necessarily the way we need to go in our elections. There are a number of state affiliates who currently handle elections by using such ideas as shapes, a square, a circle, a triangle, a rhombus, whatever, and I think probably five shapes would be sufficient for virtually any election. The idea would be that the number of registered voters is the number of shape sets that you provide, and somebody simply walks along the rows, maybe even actually while the affiliate vote is being done, collecting the appropriate shape for the candidate for whom you want to vote, and then it's relatively easy to establish whether there's been any tampering with the election simply by it's assessing whether the number of tokens that's been returned is relatively equivalent to the number of actual votes that should have been cast by the standing members who are believed to be registered. It's a pretty simple process, and what most states do is they actually issue a set of these shapes before each vote, so that it's a little bit easier. But that's, again, another relatively simple and non-technological way that you could build in a secret ballot. But the idea that I was talking about before, because I still think it is worth considering, is to create voluntary secret ballots. That is, if an individual does not choose for his or her affiliate to know how he or she votes, at the beginning of that voting process, they have the option of leaving the room and going to a designated area where a method will have been established for them to cast their vote secretly, and where they will then have to stay until that election is over. It's not a big deal, and I don't think more than probably 5 or 7% of our voters, if even that many, would choose to take advantage of the secret ballot. But they'd have the right to do it were they to feel uncomfortable. One of the groups that I think ought to be mandated to vote this way are members who are employees or contractors.
I think the problem may be that you would still have those people who would want to go to that room, but who perhaps may not feel comfortable in singling themselves out to do that. I'm not sure any one of us here in this discussion would feel that way, but when I think about many, many folks, I think that some folks might feel, well, gosh, I'd really like to vote privately, but if I do that, then they're going to think I voted X and they voted Y, so I might as well just stay here and vote Y.
Well, with regard to the first, a person would essentially leave the room before the standing vote started. And I think that the real issue here is what you're doing is leaving the room. No one really knows whether you're opting not to vote in this particular election, which a lot of people have done, by the way, rather than not vote their conscience, or whether you're going to the designated room to vote. The assumption is that most of the people who would normally be around spying on that room wouldn't be there because they're going to be inside voting, and therefore it has a higher likelihood of not requiring people to be observed. And with regard to your second question, whatever the ballot method you use inside is going to have to be a relatively simple process so that people can have the option. But let me throw out one more question. Is introducing the secret ballot in the standing vote sufficient, or do we need to introduce the secret ballot for affiliate votes as well? If we introduce the secret ballot for affiliate votes, does that not create a real danger that affiliates will in fact stuff the ballot box because there is no fear of anybody knowing how they voted?
I think there's a number of problems with the scenario of a secret ballot for affiliates. One is whoever the affiliate representative is can carry a mighty big weight. I think people would think twice about voting block from their affiliate if their affiliate could see how they were voting. And I'm not all that convinced that those same people would show any kind of restraint if people didn't see how their representative was casting their vote. Two, some of the special interest affiliates specifically pay attention to how the states vote in order to determine how they're going to split their special interest affiliate vote. They know that the vast majority of their members are from three particular states, and if those states go in a particular direction, they take part of their cue on how to divide their affiliate vote accordingly.
If we are going to essentially end up with a hybrid vote, part of which is public and part of which is secret, are we in fact defeating the whole purpose of the secret ballot and really not enabling a person to vote privately and confidentially, and therefore wasting our time with the whole process?
My greatest concern, an individual who belongs to several affiliates and a state affiliate, but my greatest concern as an individual is that I want my personal vote to be cast via a secret ballot. I personally am most of the time tough enough, and I'll stand up and vote the way I darn well want to vote and deal with what I deal with if I deal with any ramifications at all. But I am concerned that there are people who don't or who feel that they can't. And so I think if we look toward changing the voting process, that we would first look to ensure that every member has his or her own vote cast via some form of a secret ballot.
that it seems like it's a shame that there should be any ramifications for how anyone votes, no matter whether it's a secret ballot or whether they pay people to stand up or sit down or stand up to register the vote. I mean, it seems like there shouldn't be any ramifications whatsoever for how they vote.
I know as president, I chose actually not to vote, but in any other office or as a board member, I wouldn't have had the same constraints. So I'm sure people take a good look at how I vote, and I have no idea whether that impacts the way that they decide to vote. Brian, do you want to weigh in on this issue?
Again, I think privacy is a very, very important thing. I also think that short of a total redo of how ACB casts ballots from the affiliate versus the standing vote, how we calculate how many votes affiliates get, it really needs a whole overhaul that allows us not to incorporate a single alteration, but a wholesale alteration. If we're going to go to privacy, if we're going to go to one person, one vote, if we're going to do all of these things. And I think there's value in absolutely every one.
But are there any final questions or concerns that people would like to raise on the issue of elections and our Constitution?
I just want to clarify, Paul, your statement that ACB is not a membership organization. I wouldn't want anyone listening who is not a member to misunderstand that. As I understand it, and I'm pretty sure I'm correct, you can correct me if I'm not, one can and is certainly invited to join ACB as a member at large without being affiliated with one of ACB's affiliates.
Marlena, you're correct. People can be members at large, but as a proportion of our organization, members at large constitute well under 1%. Virtually all of our members come from being members of other affiliates. One of the questions that has not ever really been answered clearly and that our membership might like to have answered sometime is, what is the headcount membership of ACB as opposed to the total number of members measured by the number of affiliates times the number of members in each affiliate, which is very different from the headcount. It is the equation that I just went through that's actually used to determine ACB's membership, and therefore people are double and triple and quadruple and cinquental counted when you are trying to determine how many members ACB has. So the bottom line is, I'm not sure at the moment that anybody knows how many actual members ACB has, which is another whole question and perhaps another whole topic. Ladies and gentlemen, I very much appreciate your tuning in this evening to listen to our program about the electoral process in ACB. As I think you've discovered, there are certainly lots of interesting approaches that ACB takes to the way that we elect people, but I think that what you've also noticed is the framers of our Constitution were fairly careful to develop and implement a process that built in a number of safeguards to produce the kind of government that they wanted, a confederated or federated government where the center does not have a lot of power and where the electoral process maintains a balance between individual one-man, one-vote elections and proportional representation based on affiliate membership. The main thing about elections, wherever they occur, is that we vote and that we play a part in determining who gets elected to office. After all, in my view, and I think in the opinion of many, everyone gets the government they deserve. Thanks very much for tuning in to Tuesday Topics this evening. This is Paul Edwards in Miami, Florida, saying thank you for listening on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.